going on, everybody? Alan Kenny, managing editor of CrystalBallRun.com, the Blog UN Network's national college football blog. And we've got a little bit of a change of pace today. Big story in all of college sports right now is the looming Ed O'Bannon lawsuit. And so I've decided to bring on a really special guest. He is Warren Zola, a law professor at Boston College. And he's going to be – he's written extensively on the O'Bannon case and will be able to tell us, you know, hopefully give us just maybe the grounds of what the lawsuit's all about, as well as the implications that it could have for the college sports world in general. So I'll go ahead and bring him on. Warren, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, and thanks for having me on.
Can you give us just a little bit of an update as to where things stand right now to start off?
Sure. The case was initially filed in 2009, and if everything goes according to plan, it may be going to an actual hearing in front of a jury in 2014. So that's about a five-year span, and we are in the middle of that. And what's happening procedurally is that right now we're awaiting a date of June 20th, where in the Northern District of California, we're going to have a class certification hearing, which will decide whether or not the plaintiffs have the right as a group to move forward with this lawsuit. And so the NCAA has, in a variety of times, tried to dismiss the case, and now their efforts are attempting to break up the class of certification so that, in theory, individuals might be able to bring lawsuits forward, but not as a class action in its entirety.
Okay, and then after that ruling, when do you think we can expect to this actually to go to court?
Well, again, right now they're talking about a July 2014 trial date. I actually am dubious that we're actually ever going to get to a trial on the merits, mm-hmm. meaning certainly both sides have some interest in a settlement. I think the plaintiffs are more interested in having a settlement at this point. And the class certification hearing and its likely decision could put tremendous pressure on the defendants to settle, because a ruling against them really opens up a Pandora's box, both in terms of procedural issues, in terms of what would happen should the plaintiffs win, but also financial issues, specifically since a successful claim under antitrust law would, under the Clayton Act, have damages trebled, which really scares the heck out of the NCAA in terms of financials.
Okay, let's get in then rightly to the foundations of the lawsuit and the argument. You know, Ed O'Bannon brought this lawsuit, like you mentioned, back in 2009, and it includes right now simply just a number of former athletes who have signed on. Is that correct?
Yeah, it originally was focused on the use of current and former student athletes' likeness in video games, meaning, you know, Ed O'Bannon was sitting around one day and was literally playing EA Sports with his family. And the question was posed to him, you know, hey, look at that. That's, you know, that's you on the UCLA team. And, you know, Ed O'Bannon said, yeah, no, that's great. And I think all of a sudden a question came out, well, how much do you get paid for that? And he thought about it and said, well, actually nothing. And it was clearly him. It was, you know, while it didn't have his name on the back of his UCLA jersey, it was an African-American player who was bald, left-handed, same number, et cetera. And it occurred to him that he understood as a student athlete during his time at UCLA why he may not have had the right to be paid or compensated for the NCAA's use of his image, but he'd been out of college for almost 20 years and didn't understand at this point why he wasn't able to receive any money. And that was the genesis of his litigation against initially the NCAA and EA Sports and the college licensing company that sells these rights. And he then got some former athletes, primarily Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson, to join the litigation. And it moved forward. And last year, the plaintiffs amended their complaint, and they raised an issue of a different magnitude, which is primarily the use of student-athlete likeness in game broadcasts. And this is really important because it doesn't attack just the video game revenue, of course, which is significant, but it really looks at television revenue, which is the lifeblood of the NCAA, and says that if people are going to continue to sell video, you know, ESPN Classic, and continue to show clips of people, such as Doug Flutie's pass, why these former athletes shouldn't get compensated. And the last bit of information that as this case has moved forward is that they actually decided to include current student athletes into this litigation as plaintiffs. And that's really how it's expanded. It started off initially as former students going after student athlete likeness in video games, and now is a much broader suit going after game broadcast rights as well, and it includes current student athletes.
So aren't athletes, though, kind of signing away their licensing rights when they accept a scholarship?
Yes and no. You know, the way it stands right now, to accept a scholarship, and these are primarily year-to-year, they're not four-year guaranteed contracts, although scholarships, although the NCAA has finally allowed, after a lot of pressure, the schools to offer four-year deals. Many schools do not. Most schools do not. When you sign your scholarship offer and you accept the terms of that offer, one of the things that you do is you give away your right to the institution and likeness. And what's really a question is whether or not, number one, this is a contract of adhesion, meaning you have no ability to negotiate. This is accept their scholarship offer and sign this or don't, and you will receive no money. But also, at what point does that promise end? Is this a contract that affords the NCAA the rights in perpetuity to continue to market and sell your image way after the time that you have graduated?
Now, the NCAA, I believe, is trying to make the argument that these likenesses actually don't, I guess it's pertaining to the video games, actually don't really resemble the athletes themselves. I mean, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, I'm going to try to be kind on that one, but it clearly was, you know, it carried no weight, and I don't think anybody really bought it. And quite frankly, what we found during the discovery, when the NCAA continued to fight discovery efforts and ultimately the court supported some of these requests, what you actually found was that the game programmers actually started off by programming with actual players' names on the back of their jerseys, and before the product would hit market, they would remove the names. The NCAA has a bunch of arguments, but trying to state that these are not actually those players is clearly specious.
Okay. You mentioned the discovery process. I'm assuming that if this does start looking like it would go to trial, I'm assuming that there's going to be more to that. I mean, and if so, I mean, how damaging could that be for the NCAA?
Well, I mean, clearly this is a tremendously large concern for the NCAA, so much so that it is top of mind at NCAA meetings. You've got athletic directors and conference commissioners talking about the ramifications and requiring studies to determine what would happen should this litigation, A, move forward, and B, be successful. And I think what's happening is certainly the NCAA is trying to come up with all sorts of defenses at this point to make the case go away. And what I find interesting is that they are no longer arguing that there isn't a restraint of trade here, an illegal restraint of trade under any antitrust laws. They're really making arguments based on procedural rules and trying to break up the class action as opposed to defending on the merits of the claim. And I think that bodes well for the plaintiffs, and you know, clearly the ramifications of a successful verdict against the NCAA, EA Sports, and CLC would have broad-ranging impacts on college athletics as we know today.
What would those impacts be? I mean, if the plaintiffs are successful, I mean, what do you think that means?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of ways that this could happen. And again, I want to underscore, I really doubt that we are ever going to get to a full decision of the trial on the merits. But if the plaintiffs are entirely successful, meaning that they win and the defendants lose, there's sort of three ways, right, that could happen. I mean, clearly the NCAA could prevail in a jury trial and the verdict would be upheld and the status quo would remain. So that's scenario one. The NCAA certainly could lose the jury trial and the plaintiffs could get everything they want. And if that happens, damages in the anti-case cases are tripled. This could clearly bankrupt the NCAA and its governing body, and thereby requiring schools to actually compensate student athletes at market rate, both for their earnings after they've left, but also current student athletes and television deals. And so I think all of a sudden you're going to have a situation where you're going to have almost the development of a union for the players to negotiate, meaning in collective bargaining, antitrust laws may be ignored through what we call a labor exemption, meaning if both a union and a league agree to terms that otherwise restrain trade, but agree to those terms for the benefit of that industry, then the courts will grant the labor exemption, which then would move things forward in terms of how they would sit at a table and negotiate over the revenue that is being produced here. That's why the NFL has a draft. That's why the NBA has an age policy. You know, these are collectively bargained items that otherwise would violate trade. So certainly we've got an opportunity for complete open markets. If this case looks like it's going to be successful, the NCAA themselves could be pleading for the plaintiffs to form a union, which would then protect them from antitrust claims on labor exemption. Certainly a jury could find that there's a violation here, but not come up with any sort of real damages. You saw that in the USFL case in 1986, where the jury declared that the NFL had monopoly. They gave an antitrust claim win for the USFL, but awarded the league $1 in damages, which was, of course, were trebled, and with interest, it wound up being $3.76. So I think if this case moves forward and we get past this class certification hearing, I think most legal analysts agree that we would be stunned if there was not some level of settlement. And that's one of the things that many people are calling for, myself included, is the following. There's no doubt that change is coming to college athletics. Okay, that ship has passed. And it behooves those leaders within higher education to come to the table and really try to shape what this industry looks like, as opposed to wait for a court system or a legislature to dictate the terms of said industry.
So how would – okay, assuming that there is some type of – I mean, what would this look like? How would these athletes be paid, you know, retroactively and also going forward?
There's a whole bunch of scenarios, and no one really knows. And I think what is wonderful about this O'Bannon case is that it's finally giving a voice to those people whose rights have been trampled by the NCAA, and it's getting really smart scholars and advocates and leaders in a room beginning to debate what's the best system that we can come up with that is fair to college athletes in the industry and, quite frankly, college sports as something that many people still love. And so there's a variety of options along the spectrum that would have some support. And what people need to do is sort of figure out where along the spectrum we want. So, for example, okay, one scenario is complete free markets. Okay, and this free market plan would basically allow any school to offer any amount of money that they want for any student athlete, or probably just the revenue produced in sports of football and men's basketball. And that would be how colleges would recruit students at these schools. And what would certainly happen would be a bifurcation or a further splitting of the various levels or divisions as we know them under the NCAA. Right now we've got Division One, we've got Division Two, we've got Division Three, each with their own permutations. Division One itself could be broken up into a variety of different levels. In the very elite level, which could be, you know, five conferences or fewer, it could be 16 schools for all we know, could decide that they're going to break off into their own, and their model is literally free markets for football and men's basketball. So the elite players could be out there and could be bought with the top salaries, and recruiting would happen along those lines. So that's one scenario, which is complete open markets. That's not something that I'm proposing. I think that there is a middle ground that accomplishes much of the concerns of the plaintiffs, but also recognizes that maybe that free market system is not the ideal setup for us. And I advocate for a system that really does a couple of things. Primarily, number one, it certainly talks about closing the gap between the full cost of attendance and athletic scholarships. Right now, there's a sizable gap between what schools can offer as a full athletic scholarship in the true cost of attendance. And that gap is somewhere around $3,600, depending upon what reports are written across the country. And I'm advocating that schools are able to close that gap, coming up with payments, you know, call it around a $3,000 payment for those student athletes who are getting full scholarships. I also am a huge proponent of eliminating the restrictions on student athletes' abilities to seek commercial opportunities, and that would include endorsement deals both during and after college, so that issues like the EA sports litigation here, there's no reason in my mind why schools or student athletes wouldn't be able to benefit from those relationships and share in the revenue that's being produced. Now, we can debate what happens with those dollars while students are in school. We can certainly create a student-athlete trust fund, which is something that's been advocated before, where these funds would be held until the students graduate and then would be granted to them depending upon their graduation. If that happens, there's certainly some schools that will be able to afford these $3,000 payments per student, and there's some schools that might decide not to and stick to a model similar to what you see today, or even revert to Division III. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing.
The big elephant in the room, then, when we start talking about all this, is Title IX. How does that fit in?
Well, I think Title IX is an interesting topic for discussion. Nothing in Title IX says everyone has to get equal pay by the person. It's all about gender proportionality. It's not a specific person issue. And certainly right now, Title IX practice doesn't result in equal sports funding or equal financial aid for men and women. So if men got paid a mild amount, let's say it's $3,000, and there could be an interpretation that would mean that women had to get something proportional as well, and maybe that's how it would work out. But it also comes down to how you're going to define that payment. If it's financial aid, then yes, you might have to balance things out. If it is viewed as compensation for royalties for, you know, likeness use on image and television, et cetera, then I'm not clear that actually is going to have to be an equal component on the men versus women. And finally, if quite frankly this development means that women get some additional funding, that's all right as well.
Yeah, fair enough. So really quickly, in the broader context, I mean, what do you think this case might mean for how we view major college athletics? And
I mean, I think that people who have this concept of college athletics being amateur, because NCAA says it's amateur, is really, you know, missing the boat. You know, this is an industry that generates around $6 billion annually. And everyone gets paid very well out of this industry, right? Athletic directors, conferences, coaches, you have tremendous facilities. Schools are making a lot of money, and everyone gets paid and compensated for generating this revenue, except for the very labor that creates it. And I think that's part of this whole discussion, is beginning to realize that this is happening. And it used to be that it was only a couple of people within the sports industry that recognized that this was happening. But because of this litigation, because of these conversations, because of interviews like this, this debate is moving away from just the sports pages, and it's now being talked about at Congress and the New York Times and U.S. News and Wall Street Journal, and major commentators across the country are beginning to have these conversations. I mean, heck, it's so big it even hit the Daily Show last week. So I think that's tremendous, and we really can continue to have this debate about how to improve this industry. But make no mistake, and I've said this before, change is going to come. And whether it be the court system, whether it be legislature in California that is trying to pass a law that says it's requiring colleges that earn a certain amount of money in their state to fund this gap, which would violate NCAA rules and lead to another case, change is coming. And if the NCAA continues to put their head in the sand as opposed to try to address this and resolve this, I think we're in trouble.
All right. Well, I won't take up any more of your time this morning, Warren, but really appreciate it. Appreciate you coming on. And hopefully, maybe after the class action arguments heard, we might be able to bring you back on again and talk about this a little bit more.
Hey, absolutely. No problem.
All right. And thank you all for joining us, too. For CrystalBallRun.com, I'm Alan Kenny.